Okay, this koan here, I did, last time I did this, you may remember the picture, was in 2017, and it's somehow struck me again as a very worthwhile koan repeating a teisho on. And it's one of those koans that really describes the whole Zen journey. It's not immediately apparent, you know, when you start reading it again. It's for the uninitiated. It's a, you know, you think, what's happening here? So we need to unpack it a little bit for those that don't know. Of course, those that are working on koans post-mu, those that have had an experience, they are asked to unpack it themselves, and that is not always easy. But I'll start off by reading it, and then we'll go through it. So it's case 15, Book of Equanimity, Kyozan thrusts his hoe in the ground. Instruction. To know before it is said is known as silent discussion. To have it appear, although it is not clarified, is known as dark activity. To press the palms together before the main gate and perform kin-hin under the eaves has a meaning. But what about doing a dance in the garden and nodding your head under the back gate? The case. Isan asked Kyozan, "Where have you been?" Kyozan said, "In the rice field." Isan said, "How many people are there in the rice field?" Kyozan thrust his hoe into the ground and stood with his hands folded on his chest. Isan said, "Today many people are cutting thatch on the South Mountain." Kyozan took up his hoe and immediately left. The verse. The old enlightened one's feelings are many as he worries about his descendants. Now he feels shame and raises up the family gate. This requires remembering the story of the South Mountain, carving it in the bones and impressing it on the skin to mutually repay the debt of gratitude. So, like I usually do, is I just explain a little bit about the characters in the koans. This is, by the way, the Book of Equanimity. So this is one compilation by Shinjin Wick, American, I guess he is an academic and also a Zen teacher, of course. He translated this particular edition, if you like, then he also wrote a little commentary on each case. Our translations from at Sanbo Zen vary a little bit. I mean, we always, you know, Sanbo Zen has its own scholars, and they usually always debate about what the right word is to use. It's very difficult quite often to do give translations justice. So our translations are a little bit different, but it's worthwhile knowing that there are different translations, and sometimes just a different word may just all of a sudden put a completely different meaning on a koan. So this is always quite interesting to look at that. So the Book of Equanimity originally was compiled by Master Wanchi. He lived in the Tang Dynasty. He was born 1091 and died in 1246. So he is the original compiler. So he would have gone somehow collected all these different sayings, dialogues, and compiled them together. And he also wrote the verse that was Master Wanchi. Then about 100 years later, Master Bensho came along. And he wrote another preface to it. So similar to Gary Wick, his, you know, thousands of years afterwards, he wrote a commentary on it. So we have many, many different masters writing different commentaries or verse, and that's what happens. In our tradition, we only deal with the case as in Dokusan, but the verses and the introductions are always very interesting, and sometimes, of course, we also deal with the verse in Dokusan as well. What's also interesting is Master Bensho. So he's the one that 100 years afterwards wrote the commentary on this. His stupa still exists today in Beijing. So his ashes are still there and can be seen. In fact, the stupa Parodas exists today in downtown Beijing in Xiamen Street in the Xizi area, for those that know Beijing. So you can still visit that. That's quite interesting. Okay, then we've got Izan in the case as well. So you got Izan and Kyozan. And what's interesting about Izan and Kyozan is that they were the founders of the Igyo school. So remember, there were five schools in the Tang dynasty. So there's the Igyo school, the Hogen school, the Unmon school, Soto school, and Rinzai school. So classically today, out of those, only the Soto and Rinzai, as I've said many, many times, are left. And of course, the Zanbo Zen school is there as well nowadays. And that is a school, as you would know, that really made its mark, especially in the Western world, because they teach, it's a lay householder lineage rather than a monastic lineage, and it combines elements of both Soto and Rinzai. The Igyo school was famous for one thing, and that was they didn't get into debate about sudden and gradual awakening. They sort of integrated both as part of the path, which is very similar to what Sanbo Zen does as well. So that was one of their hallmarks. And of course, the founders, which are represented here in the koans. In the koan today, Izan and Kyozan are, you know, they're seen as very clear. And they almost, in the koan, and the word dance is used, they almost perform a dance in this dokusan. And so we'll go through that in a minute. So they very clear, as I said, and they had many disciples, but of course the school didn't survive. Nevertheless, okay. So that's a little bit on that. Izan was obviously he was the teacher. He lived from 771 to 853. And Kyozan lived from 807 to 883, Tang Dynasty, China. So Kyozan was his student, but they were very, very closely aligned. I mean, sometimes you have the title of teacher and student, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the teacher is always clearer than the student either. So that's just the title that we give each other depending on the function. So function obviously is very important, but underlying that function, whether it's a student or a teacher, the great matter doesn't care about function. It's just we do, and of course it has its function, has its meaning. Okay, so let's just go through and look at the case. The introduction first. To know before it is said is known as silent discussion. That starts off with that. It's very simple. To know before it is said is set aside. So quite often we know before it is said what is meant. Just especially partners living together, you just give each other a look, and that look says it all. And so before it is said, we know we're in trouble, or we know we've got approval, or we know whatever. So to know before it is said, you know, is called a silent discussion. And that happens quite often. You know, you see it a little, you know, especially eye raising. And, there's a whole thing on body language, of course, nowadays. But that really is refers to this. And, of course, this refers to the koan. So there's a lot. So when we go through the koan, pay attention to certain things happen in that dialogue that it's we just know before it is said, you know. And quite often in dokusan as well, with a teacher and a student, to know before it is said, like the way a student walks into the dokusan room, to know before it is said, you know where the student is at. If it's a half-assed job, then that's what happens. You know before it is said. You know, you come into the dokusan room, or the way you put your shoes outside. I always mention when I was in Japan at Sesshin, at the time the Roshi said, I know the state of mind of what's happening in the Zendo by the way the shoes are aligned. You know, that is to know before it is set, you know, whether people are really mindful and they're really serious or not. You know, that's just another example. So pay attention to that one. Of course, a classic example of that is also in the transmission, like in the transmission of the Dharma or in the transmission of the great matter. In other words, if someone has really got it, if they got it, whatever it is we're doing, if they got what it's all about, if they've transcended this life and death question, you know, it doesn't need to be said. And one famous example, of course, is Mahakashyapa twirling the flower, and Mahakashyapa smiling. It's just silence. You just know that there's a knowing there that they got it. You know, of course, that takes quite a bit of intuition, and but it does, and I think we all can relate to it to some degree. The next line is also very interesting. To have it appear, although it is not clarified, is known as dark activity. Okay. To have it appear, although it is not clarified, is known as dark activity. So dark activity here means, dark means you can't see it. But, you know, when I looked at this again this time around, what came to me was, when it's dark, I've got no reference point. When it's really pitch black, you know, there is no reference point. That's marvelous. You know, that is actually where we are going in our sitting. If we are moving and we are in samadhi, or we're entering the jhanas, as they would say in the Pali tradition. In other words, everything stops. And at that moment, no reference point. And that no reference point is what gives us the peace. That is what transcends karma. That is what actually, if for those that have got an inkling of that, draws us back to come back to meditation all the time, because we want that. We want to experience that. And that is what he calls here, the way I look at it anyway, is to have it appear, although it is not clarified. Clarified, in other words, it's not logical. You know, to have it not even clarified, as in, you know, that might just happen to us. To be in that space, you know, is known as dark activity. You could also say that Dokusan work is the dark activity, because in Dokusan we are asked to penetrate a koan, and the koan, when we read the koan first up, it's like, oh, what does this mean? We are looking at it. We are looking at it, you know, from the point of view of discrimination. Here are the words, and what do they mean? You know, so in many ways, that's the light shines on it, and as soon as the light shines on it, we discriminate. He said, this is this. I can see a wall, I can see James, I can see Margaret. I discriminate straight away, you know. So the dark activity is to be in that space of no reference point. Certainly no self-referencing, which gets in the way with a lot of things. So that this is the way I look at that. And of course, the experience of that no reference point gives us a reference. You know, if we have that experience, we call it Kensho, of course, in Zen, as you would all know. If we have that experience, that gives us a reference in itself, which can be dangerous in one way, because then it just becomes we look it into a memory and we keep on harping back on that. But at the same time, it is that reference point also gives us an awareness when we are not there. So like even today, when I was sitting there and meditating, my mind was wandering and my awareness kicked in saying, hey, my mind is wandering. That reference point of darkness is where I want to go. And I just make sure my mind goes back to mooing. Because when I'm mooing, or when I have an object of meditation, my references drop away. They just keep on dropping away, so I can enter into that dark spot again. So that's the dark activity. This is the way I read this. The other way of looking at it is no insight. In the dark spot, there's no inside and no outside. If it's dark, you don't know, inside, outside, just darkness. Beautiful, beautiful space. Obviously, multiple layers of perceptions there. You know, again, coming back to a koan, so if the famous koan, the oak tree in the garden, what is Buddha? The oak tree in the garden. You know, to what degree, you know, can I see the darkness of the oak tree? In other words, am I caught in that on all of the referencing about oak tree? Or can I see oak tree without any identity whatsoever? You know? So again, this comes back to that that experience. And it doesn't matter whether it's an oak tree, it can be a phone, it can be a piece of paper, it can be a person. To what degree can I see it? Is really also that work of, as he puts it there, the dark activity. And you know, we can work on that all the time. To press the palms together, goes on in the introduction, to press the palms together before the main gate and perform kinhin under the eaves has a meaning. So pressing the palms together, you know, like you could say, to press the palms together in our zendo before we do kinhin has a meaning. So this was a contradiction now. As in, the dark space is, we let go of it all, especially meaning. But then he says, you know, in the introduction, it has a meaning, you know. And that, of course, refers to that we cannot remain in the dark space. You know, remaining there, and some people will want that. They keep on meditating. They want to be in that spot. It's like they want to continuously access that bliss that we get, that of not having a reference. Because without a reference, we can't be anxious. Without a reference, we can avoid all the troubles in the world. There's not. It's just very, very peaceful. A lot of people want to remain there, you know. But here he says to press palms together before the main gate and perform kinin under the eaves has a meaning. Or to go to work has a meaning. Or to get up from your cushion and get back into the car and go home has a meaning, you know. So this is what this is referring to. I'd just like to read you out, you've heard it all before, what Wei Xin, another Tang Dynasty master, what he wrote, I don't know exactly when he wrote it, but many, many years ago, he wrote this. 30 years ago, before I began the study of Zen, I said mountains are mountains and waters are waters. After I got an insight into the truth of Zen through the instructions of a good master, I said mountains are not mountains, waters are not waters. But now, having attained the abode of final rest, I say mountains are really mountains and waters are really waters. So it's a beautiful example of this. You know, it's that in the beginning, well, there's a mountain, there's Pat, there's this, there's that, there's that. Then we have this realization that through that dark activity, through sitting, no, we don't, it's gone. There's no reference, it's gone. The mountains disappear. What do you mean mountains? It's just nothing, there's nothing at allness, as the Roshi always says. But then again, after it's matured, we come back out of that. We go back, as he says, performing kinin under eaves has a meaning. We go back into the world of functionality, because that's where we live. We go back into the world of duality, because that is how we communicate, you know. But we see it completely differently. All of a sudden, they're really mountains. We really see what it is, and that is the difference. So this is quite often also interpreted as first there's self, then there's non-self, then there's true self. The same sort of principle applies here as well. Okay, then in the introduction it goes on. But what about doing a dance in the garden and nodding your head under the back gate? What about doing a dance in the garden and nodding your head in the back gate? So here, the dance, of course, a dance is free to do a dance in the garden. I mean, who does a dance in the garden? Can you really do a dance in the garden? Sure, James does. You can see. A dance. It's lovely to be able to do a dance in the garden. And that is like, it's referring back to the dance of the koan. Have a look at the koan. There's a dance happening. And it's just a beautiful dance in a form of a dialogue, you know, between these two masters. And that is what he's referring to. And nodding your head in approval not, you know, or jamming or whatever, however you want to see that. Okay, so then we get to the koan. The case. Aizen, so he's the teacher, asked Kyozan, "Where have you been?" And Kyozan said, "In the rice field." Now, of course, you've heard me, I've done many teishos on "Where have you been?" You know, but I just can never get enough of this. Where have you been? It just immediately transports me to another level when I hear that. Where have you been? That is the question. It is the same question, but very directly, as what is mu. Where have you been? You know, of course, and from an ordinary perspective, you know, first I saw mountains were mountains and waters are waters. From an ordinary discriminatory perspective, where is based on where? It's geography. Have you been time? You, me, where have I been in time and in space? Where have I been in time and space? Where have you been? Okay. So that is the way most people reference things. Where have you been? Where have you been? It's like that drives, if you like, samsara. That drives all the suffering, this separateness of, and this immersion of ourselves in the conceptual space of time and space. Yeah. Where have you been? So that is really a fundamental Zen question. We must find an answer to that. Of course, you know, in the koan here, we'll unpack it and we'll look at it. But that is not good enough. You really need to experience this. You need to be able to say with all conviction, I have experienced where I have been. And when you can say where you have been, then you also know who you are. Who are you is the same question. But where have you been, in a way, really, really nails it, really targets it. It really nails it. Where have you been? So quite often it is seen. As a checking question. What we call a checking question. So the master asks, "Where have you been?" So depending on the student's attainment, depending on the student's level, you know, we can get into an esoteric or a philosophical argument about that. Oh, there's no time. There's no space. Oh, yeah. But really nailing it, you know, at those three levels. First, there's a mountain. The mountains are mountains and waters are waters. Then there's no mountain and there's no waters. Then they're really mountains. So based on those three perspectives, you know, we need to look at that question of where have you been? Where have you been? Or we can look at it from that perspective. Okay. Where have you been? You look at that from that perspective of the dark activity. Imagine a pitch black room. Then you ask that question, where have you been? And all you see, of course, if your mind kicks in and answers that question, you know, from a memory point of view, then that darkness is no longer there because you're then occupied in your memory. But at that moment when you are sitting in meditation, where have you been? Does not even come into it. It's just being. It's just you are. It's just immersion into it. You know, where have you been? So that really requires an experience. And again, I have mentioned it many times before. When I had my first, what I call my first real experience of this was flying, and I realized that I cannot go anywhere. I mentioned it many times. An experience like that. That is a reference point where you really can say, you know, I cannot go anywhere. I've never gone. And I cannot go anywhere. So I've never gone and I cannot go anywhere. I'm always here. To be able to say that, the I needs to disappear. The I needs to be gone, total darkness, you know, to be able to really truly. Of course, the eye kicks back in again because I cannot function without an eye. Of course, the eye kicks in because that is the functionality of who Arno is. Arno has an eye, big eye, and that kicks in again. But now with that reference point, where I can sit on the cushion, and if my mind wanders, where have you been, Arno? Just instantly get to that spot. So this is that question. Where, that is a very, very powerful question. Where have you been? The other thing I like to say is I like to just briefly mention Rosalind. As you all heard, or most of you would have heard, that Rosalind has passed away. And she did it her own way. By that I mean. She had medical assisted dying done in Canada. Rosalind was, for those that don't know, Rosalind was Mervyn's teacher. Who's met Rosalind here in this room? Have you ever met Rosalind? Okay, no one. I thought maybe Patton. And what about you, Sheila? Have you met Rosalind? Once, okay. So Rosalind was, if you like, my grand teacher, you know, grandmother, teacher, you know, in the lineage, my grandmother in the lineage as far as teachers are concerned. I did many sessions, when I say many, probably 5 or 6 sessions with Rosalind myself. I really enjoyed Kenshukai with Rosalind at the various teachers' conferences. Rosalind actually gave a Kenshukai for the Australian teachers here in Brisbane 1 year, which I also attended, which was lovely. And when I wrote my thesis, she gave me some information, background information, especially on Yamada Roshi when she worked with Yamada Roshi. So we had a great correspondence going on for a number of months, and she helped me with some questions that I had as well. Always very fond of Rosalind. Rose is a very strict teacher, and a lot of the classical Zen that I tend to convey here really comes from Rosalind, because she's a first generation Western teacher that taught in Japan. She didn't teach in Japan. She was a student in Japan under Yamada Kohan Roshi, not the current, not Masamichi Roshi, or Ryan Roshi as he's also known. So very, very fond of Rosalind, and very strong lady, lots of respect for her. And when it was announced, so I knew maybe 2 or 3 weeks before she decided to have a voluntary euthanasia, I knew before then that was happening. And I was on my trip in Australia, going around Australia, as you know, and it did occupy me a lot. Wow, I thought to myself, that is what a thing to do, you know. She was still very clear-minded, and she also was diagnosed with dementia and some aggressive form of dementia. And so she made the decision that's what she wanted to do. So she set a date. She had to go through all the procedures. That's what she wanted to do. And she did. I think it was 2 weeks ago she had it done. So what the question that where my mind went with all of this was, what is the state of mind of Rosalind, right? What is the state of mind of Rosalind to be able to do this? You know, you imagine, you set your own death sentence. Okay, on this day, I'm going to get the needle and I'm going to die. You know, so obviously, being healthy is unimaginable. You know that, like, I wouldn't do it. Of course not. You know, but then again, when I am in that dark, when I am in that dark space, and I know dark seems like a funny, but when I am in samadhi, when I access this no reference point, you know, it's quite easy. Actually, it's not a big deal. It's like, and at that moment, anything could happen, and it's perfectly okay. There's a difference, you know. And I thought to myself, that is really what it means to take refuge in the Buddha. Meaning, taking refuge in the Buddha, taking refuge in awakening, taking refuge in that clarity, in that space that we inhabit when we see it all, that's really what it comes down to. And when we really truly can take refuge, you know, to me, then dying, non-dying, it's just peace. There's just, that's what it is. It's just another word for it, of course, but, you know, anyway, that's the way it made sense to me. And I could sort of, you know, when I looked at it that way, and I thought, yeah, I just really hope, and I think it is the case, that Rosalind is at that spot, that she could make that decision and say, hey, you know, I don't want to go through all of this. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to set a date, and on that day, I'm gone. It's the same with taking refuge in the Buddha, taking refuge in the Dharma, meaning the teachings. Like taking, even just reading this koan, you know, it just transports us into this world of oneness. And in this world of oneness, there's no separation. I can never leave that world. I can never ever leave that world. But of course, it's easy said. You've got to experience that. And once you've experienced that, it is an easy thing. It would be an easy thing. You know? So the Dharma gets us there too, in a way. You know? And Sangha is, well, those people that get it. It's also the Sangha. And if you can share that with someone, it's very liberating. So taking refuge, that's one thing that this whole exercise has done to me, is it's clarified what taking refuge really means, you know, especially when it comes to moments like that. So anyway, I just thought I'll share that with you as well. So now coming back to this koan, Izan asked Kyuzan, where have you been? And Kyuzan said, in the rice field. So that was his answer, in the rice field. Again, we can look at that from a mountain is a mountain, and a rice field is a rice field, and waters is waters. Or we can look at it from, there's no rice field, there's no waters. There are no mountains. Or we can look at it from, I can really see the rice field. I can really see the waters. I can really see the mountains. So, of course, the teacher does not know when the teacher asks the student, where do you come from? You say, I come from the Sunshine Coast. The teacher doesn't know where that student is at. Is he in the first? Is he still caught up in self, as in discriminating me and you and there and here and Sunshine Coast there? Or is he at that level of, probably not at that level, there is no ma, because they would have answered differently. But or is he at that third level? And of course, Kyuzan knows, because they know each other so well. After a while, the student knows the teacher, and the teacher knows the student. They know each other so well. So the answer is, you just start laughing, because you all know, we know where people are at. And that all you can do is laugh. And it is a laugh, and it's just like a dance as well, you know? Because it is ridiculous. It is such a ridiculous thing to say, and it's such a ridiculous thing to do. That's the way it is, and it is, it's in its absurdity, it is really, it's funny, but it is profound. It is so profound, you know. So Kyuzan said, in the rice field. So what is the rice field? Again, great question. What is the rice field? It's like asking, what is stick? What is the stick? Or who am I? What is Brisbane? What is Buddha? You know, all of these things that we discriminate, they all have an identity that we have assigned to it. Once we get rid of the identity, we can answer that. We get stuck on identity. In other words, we get stuck on rice food. We get stuck on space and time. we get stuck on 12 o'clock being 12 o'clock and Ricefield being a Ricefield and Sunshine Coast being the Sunshine Coast. We get stuck on these elements, you know. So how do you see Ricefield is a really, really important question. I'd just like to say that from my own experience, I can never leave the Ricefield. It's impossible. And that is why I believe that it would have been quite easy for Rosalind. She couldn't leave the Ricefield either, and she's seen that. You cannot leave the Ricefield. You cannot leave the Sunshine Coast. You cannot leave anything. You cannot go anywhere. You cannot leave Kin Hin. But again, that needs to be seen. So, of course, he said, where do you come from? He said, the Ricefield. So now, Izan probes further because he wants to see how does he really, in which stage is he on? So that's an answer that could go many, many ways. So he pushes him further to see where he goes with this. Where is he? How does he see Ricefield? How does he see Ricefield? And so he asks, how many people are there in the Ricefield? How many people are there in the Ricefield? So all of a sudden he brings the element of separation in again. How many people? Is Ricefield the oneness of it all? Just calling it Ricefield? How many people are there? And Kyozan thrusts his hoe into the ground. So that's his answer. How many people in the Ricefield? Whoa! Here you go. It's like, how many stars are in heaven? Whoa! Here you go. How many coronavirus, whatever, putations are there by now? Whoa! How many? How many people die each day? Whoa! You know, it's like, that was his answer, very powerful answer. How many people in the rice will? Bam! And that, you know, that is obviously a classical Zen answer. Because Zen, in a way, has its own methods of teaching and its own methods of demonstrating, show me, show me, show me. So that answer shows that he is not stuck in so many people. Let me count. I think there were about 57 people in the rice field. Yeah. It shows that he looks at that, he's seen what rice field really is. He's seen what it is. Now, in other words, he's seen that there is no rice field. There's just, whoa, rice field. Now, it continues. Aizan is not happy with that answer. No, he says, no, 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 no. So, the next question that he says is, but today, many people are cutting thatch on the South Mountain. A lot of people are harvesting wheat. How can you say that Ricefield is just that? What a stupid thing to say. What a ridiculous thing to say. In other words, get out of your Zen mind. Get out of that emptiness. Get out of that mind that keeps you stuck in that, get out of the dark spot, get into the light. That's what he's saying, you know, with that question. Today, how many people are cutting thatch on the road? So that's that last question. Now as you really see that mountains are mountains, I really see that waters are waters. So that is coming back to function, going back into the marketplace. But seeing it truly for what it is, you know, not swapping around again, and that again, it's a fine thing. Seeing it truly for what it is, you know. So today, many people are cutting thatch on the South Mountain. There's work to be done. Don't sit there and meditate all day long and spend all their time doing it. These people are hungry. You know, food needs to be put on the table. People are sick. They need to be healed. Houses need to be built. Prisoners need to be kept in check. Engineering drawings need to be made, and all of this. Yeah. So this is really what he's saying there. And that integration part, you know. So what did Kyozan do? He took up his hoe and he left. So here you could argue, in our culture we might say, oh, he left as in, what does that mean, leaving? Is that disapproval? Is that, you know, again, it's a great question. What does that mean, leaving? He left. Can he leave? You know? What was the state of mind of Kyozan when he left is a Dokusan question as well. So what's the difference between being in the rice field and leaving? Or what's the difference between sitting and walking? What's the difference between... These are older questions that that point to this as well. Okay, so we go to the verse. The old enlightened one's feelings are many as he worries about his descendants. James asked me today, oh, you look worried. Oh, I worry about the descendants. It's a bit like that. The old enlightened one's feelings are many as he worries about his descendants. So, of course, that the function of a monk and the function of a teacher is to make sure that world that is shared with as many people as possible. Because that is really the world where we access peace for the first time, where we can see through all of the discriminations that are happening. And that gives us really frees us in many ways, or in all ways, you know. So that's what this line refers to. The old enlightened one's feelings are many as he worried about his descendants. Now he feels shame and raises up the family gate, you know. So this could refer to, and in some commentaries, could refer to Kyozan realizing that he needs to go back away from this dialogue, back into the rice field, and actually do the work that needs to be done, these daily chores, you know. So raising up the family gate is coming back to being real, going back and doing the work. You know, not spending too much time on this Zen stuff and sitting and philosophizing about it all, working on koans, going back again, raising up the family. That's function, coming back to function again. This requires remembering the story of the South Mountain. So we need to get reminded of that. You know, that this Zen journey that we're on is always in the context of our life. It's in the context of our day-to-day activity. This is not an escape. It is always in that context, you know, and it is really important that we get reminded on that. Carving it in the bones and impressing it on the skin to mutually repay the debt of gratitude. In other words, we make it our own path. Yeah. Carving it in the bones is like this practice reconditions us. I mean, we all got a conditioning of seeing things from a separate perspective, but this practice reconditions us to get different perspectives, different reference points. And so that is what is meant. So that ultimately, when we go back into the marketplace, That is how we live it. We don't need to say it anymore. We don't need to make any reference. We are it, you know, through our activity, through our conduct, through our personality. That is what that's the way I look at it here. It becomes, if you like, we have a purpose, and that purpose is somehow underlines all of our activity. But without even having to say it like that. Thank you.